I'm John Batchelor. Energy savings, the challenge of Ukraine conflict, the challenge of global warming, the challenge of demand side, supply side. I welcome Professor Felix Kreuzig, Professor of Sustainability Economics of Human Settlement at Technical University Berlin, who is also the Scientific Coordinator Climate Change Center for the IPCC and the coordinating lead author of the IPCC's sixth assessment report to look at what is to be done. First, the problem. The problem is, of course, climate change, but most pressingly, given the meetings of these last days and the concerns about Ukraine, it's the slow turnoff of energy resources from Russia, a hostile power. Professor, a very good day to you. Thank you. You report in your piece at Nature magazine, the premier peer-reviewed science magazine in Europe and the world. What is the problem, Professor? How does Germany see this problem right now? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. The key problem is that we have a very acute situation in Germany, in all of Europe, that we are very much dependent on Russian gas, Russian oil, Russian coal, on all fossil fuel resources. And, of course, we don't want that because we are financing the war in Ukraine currently. And, of course, we are super dependent. That means we try to reduce that, but also Russia is cutting off gas. And that leaves the threat that in the next winter, Germany and other European countries don't have enough gas to heat our homes.
So you're going to be cold, you're going to have very high prices, and also you have various food shortages around the world that can translate into empty places at the supermarket, not because we don't have the food, but because we don't have the trucks to deliver the food to the supermarket where we buy it. All right, so we've got a major problem that is global, not just in Germany, although you helped me to understand that Germany now is politically transforming from a policy of many decades called Ostpolitik to making solutions. We have the demand side. We have a solution. It's called demand side. What is the potential for two things, for energy use, energy usages, and for greenhouse gases if when we go to the demand side response?
Yeah, the key idea is that you want to get away from the fossil fuels, and for two reasons, to get away from this dependency and to also make the savings in a socially responsible way, but of course also to cut greenhouse gas emissions, because we have only very few years left to really address the global heating problem. You already experienced now heat waves in all continents that are dramatic to many people. You have a very short time to get really on the path towards climate change mitigation.
I'm glad you mentioned the climate, the heat wave, because there is a severe drought in the west of the United States. You know that Lake Mead, the Hoover Dam, is at an all-time low. And they're talking about water shortages in California, even electricity shortages throughout the west. But in Europe, I'm following the story in the Po River Valley, where the hydropower is no longer reliable because the Po River and its tributaries are so low. Then add the drought, and then add the heat wave that extends into Indo-Europe, the Indo-Pacific. So what we have is we call it a perfect storm, Professor, driving all of these concerns. I want to make certain we understand that your recommendations would be an immediate consequence and a long-term consequence. Do I say that correctly? Not only would we challenge the question of cutoff of energy resources from Europe and the worldwide food shortages, but we would also contribute to the reducing of greenhouse gases over the century. Did I read you correctly?
Exactly. So what we can do now is cutting demand from fossil gas and natural gas, and also from oil, which is the main revenue for Russia. We can cut that by 30-60% in 12 to 18 months in a very short time frame. And that would reduce also global greenhouse gas emission immediately by 3%. But there are much more measures that we can take over the next two decades. We will actually realize greenhouse gas emission of at least 50% globally without even considering the supply side issues like more photovoltaic and more wind.
So supply side, yes. Let's get to the three areas you identify in your reporting: transport, building, and food. We start with transport. Right now, one way to describe transport is to move from a fossil fuel-based automobile to an electric automobile. And that is underway, although variously. I understand you have expectations in Germany to do how much of the fleet in the next 5 years can be electrified, Professor?
Yeah, that's the goal of having 15 million electric vehicles on the road to 2030 in Germany, which is about 30% of all vehicles. But it might even get faster. So there's now probably legislated a ban of selling fossil fuels in Europe in 2035. And if cities take the initiative to ban fossil fuels driving in cities, which may also happen, then there's a strong incentive to only buy electric cars now, which is already cost competitive with other cars. So this kind of change may happen quite quickly and is very welcome. Still, it's not enough to address the climate crisis.
I want to stay with banning cars in cities. You're talking about fossil fuel cars right now. Has this started already, banning fossil fuel vehicles in cities, and is Germany considering it?
It's happening in some cities. In Spain, for example, it's a measure to actually improve inner city life. So what you see as a result of that, that more people go to the street, hang out, go to restaurants. So it's actually improving the economy of the inner city and the quality of life, of course. So that's a main incentive for cities to go into that. And there's much more potential to do that, because currently also European cities, which from an American side may look very romantic, still they are full of parked cars, which prohibit street life.
Yes, I've tried to walk down the sidewalks of some of those cities. The cars are parked on the... They're parked up on the sidewalk with me. That's what I've always I've always puzzled. I think it's worse in Italy, but really it just depends on what old city you're in. Now, how is the public responding to this? Because a major concern that you present is equity. That is, the savings of fuel, the cost of fuel, hits different parts of the population differently. How does banning cars help equity?
So, like, one overarching strategy is you save fuels, for example, by telecommuting or by banning cars in inner cities, then there's less demand on gas, and then the prices go down at the pump station, and those who really need, for example, the commuters or those on the countryside who really need to buy gasoline, they get it for affordable prices. So that's one of the part why this is an equitable strategy.
The concern also is in banning cars in cities, that will very much change the way the city earns money. It will emphasize one part, which is the pedestrian, and it will de-emphasize the ability to dash into the city, go to the theater, and get back home. So you'll put a big load on mass transportation. In New York City, they've converted to hydrogen-based mass transit, I believe, although the subway is the old clanking around oil-driven. Are you converting your mass transportation to electric or hydrogen-driven in Germany?
Yes, definitely. Like most mass transit is electrified on rails, so that's already there. But the bus fleets are running on diesel, and the Berlin government will have all of its buses running on electric buses, actually, until 2030. So that's well on its way. It's a good goal. You mentioned an important point. Not all cities can go the strategy, because if you don't have accessible mass transit, you can't ban cars, because people are just too depending on that. But I would like to emphasize a very positive insight, and that is, all streets that have banned cars, they have more people on the street, and the local business is making more revenue. So it's actually a boon for the local shops if cars are banned and if there are more people cycling and walking there.
All right, we move from transport. Banning cars is a major thing. Telecommuting, of course, cuts down. We've learned that in the pandemic. It cuts down commuting, which makes the commute easier and at the same time doesn't demand a lot of costs at the pump. You know, our prices are not as high as yours, Felix, but they're a challenge because we have longer distances routinely to drive. We moved to building. What is your recommendation for the temperature of homes in wintertime?
It's to regulate it to not heat up more than 66 or perhaps 70 degrees Fahrenheit. It should be regulated because the poor households, they do it anyway, they can't afford more. But if it's done for everyone, then also the gas price, natural gas prices go down and it benefits the consumers. It's probably a necessity because in Europe, there won't be natural gas enough in the winter. There will be strong price signals. Natural gas is important for the industry, for glass manufacturing, steel manufacturing. So there will be price signals also for the industry. It will be really a crunch time for Europe in the next 24 months in the energy sector.
So you're recommending 19 degrees Celsius for those listening in Celsius countries, about 66 degrees Fahrenheit. That's cold, Felix. That'd be a cold winter. I spoke to a friend of mine in Scotland, and his response was, that's a two-jumper winter, two-sweatered winter. Now, attached to that, because heating is a major challenge for Europe, I read this all the time now, here's the puzzle. When we convert that way, 66 degrees, what do you recommend? Imposing it? Intervening? You also call something about social prestige. How would that work?
I think important is to officially announce that this is the new social norm or regulated. You can't actually check it. You can't really go into households to check whether people have it only like 66 degrees Fahrenheit. But it could become a social norm. That this is really something that helps society if you don't heat up your home too much yourself. But I would like to add another strategy here. And it's more fun. It's like gamification of households. But what we do is that we are using energy in house, and we actually don't know how much energy it is. But if you get direct feedback of the energy cost, then it becomes fun to save energy. Like one issue is like warm water is a key category. And if we actually measure in time how much warm water and how much energy we are just wasting when we are showering or something, then it's like just knowing the information will help us save the energy by 20% immediately.
Right.
So this kind of feedback is really helpful.
You mentioned the utilities can help us because they can not only give us smart temperatures, they can give us compare and contrast. For example, how much energy we're using for heat compared to the neighborhood or the county we live in. Do I read you correctly?
Yes, there's in science say there's descriptive norms. That's what you're mentioning. So like knowing how much energy we spend in comparison to others is helpful to have orientation and to give us a feeling for how much we can save ourselves. But also injunctive norms. So if we also communicate this is really good, then it also helps to have a direction like how to use energy in households.
We heat our homes here in America with oil heat. Not natural gas so much. We use natural gas for other things like fires and flames. Oil heating is very expensive, Felix. So what you're talking about is reducing the cost of maintaining heat in the home, not only reducing the temperature. Now, there's one part of building that's fresh to me. How does reducing the steel in the building codes help?
Yeah, using a lot of energy and a lot of greenhouse gas emission in the building sector, like building homes. So just think about like a 100 square meter apartment in Germany typically has about 100 tons of CO2 in cement and steel. It's really a lot. And here's the opportunity to just change that. So you can build more like with wooden materials. You can use actually digitization and 3D printing to have very efficient structures where you have less material input. But perhaps most importantly, they're often old building structures. And instead of destroying them and building a new housing, you can adapt them with new purposes and renovate them. And by this, you actually save again a lot of energy, especially also in steel, which is getting much more expensive with rising energy prices.
I'm speaking to Felix Kreutzig, Professor of Sustainability of Economics of Human Settlements at Technical University Berlin, the Scientific Coordinator Climate Change Center, as well as the coordinating lead author of the IPCC's sixth assessment report. We're talking about reducing demand side in response to Ukraine conflict, in response to global warming. However, when we come back, the really tough one, food. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.